done very, very nicely with everybody who's seen it on Rotten Tomatoes. It's got like a 90-something rating or whatever.
Really?
Have you looked at the...
No, I haven't.
You know, the...
Yes, I know the site. Everything. Right, wow.
So...
Is that people that have seen the movie or just know about it?
It's reviewers. It's a collection of everybody who's seen it. And they, those who subscribe, of course, to Rotten Tomatoes, who send their stuff in. But it has a creme de la creme and a mainstream critics, and the rating is, well, yeah.
This
is very, you know. So it occurred to me that, is it the best reviewed thing since Living in Oblivion for you, or what's the best,
wow.
What's the cat, what's the way of...
I wasn't even, listen, first of all, that's news to me. I didn't know that. I mean, I've been living kind of just in this world of doing whatever I can do to just help the film, you know. I didn't know that.
Just check when you get back.
I will. I mean, it's funny that you say that. Oblivion got some good reviews.
Some?
It did. Not a lot. Not a lot. Let me tell you something. You know what killed the movie? Siskel and Ebert. You know what they gave it? 2 thumbs down.
You're kidding
me. No, I'm not kidding. And so Sony Classics, who was distributing the film, this was their whole motivation to get the film out into the heartland,
yeah.
Right? Killed it. So we had no middle American release. Someone in the New Yorker magazine, someone, a critic whom I greatly respected, trashed the movie. Said it's just a one-joke film for filmmakers. And I went, why say that? That's crazy. But in general, it got good reviews. Janet Maslin gave it a nice review in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
And so in general, I would say, yes, it was well-reviewed, but it wasn't the kind of press that enabled it to, you know, move out of art house theaters. So,
you know, there's the old saying that a film that feels like it's astoundingly well received at Sundance doesn't travel. It doesn't go when you go down to sea level.
Right.
But I really.
Is that where you saw the movie?
That's where I first saw it.
Oh, wow. Did you go to that big screening?
Yeah. Library, right?
Wasn't that a nice screening?
That was one of the most amazing things I've ever.
God, the audience was just so into it.
I mean, it's like a play. If movies have the right audience and they get it.
You're so right. And what infuriated me the most was any time we ever had to try to, you know, submit the film for this or for that. You know how they did it? They did it on DVD where guys were just sitting in their empty offices and never got the sense of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not just saying this because I know that every director would tell you the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I've done enough movies to know. This is a movie that something magical happens when the audience is there. Mm-hmm. I know it. And what more could you want in terms of a movie-going experience?
Mm-hmm.
I believe that so much, that the theater experience is part of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And we're losing that. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
I mean, there's something so intensely powerful about sitting in a group of 100, 200 people,
mm-hmm.
and something happens. It's not a mass hysteria. What it is that... Something comes alive emotionally that they're getting from the film. That's a powerful thing.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Now, I'm presuming that you, in creating Delirious, obviously you're a Manhattanite from way back, and you know the world of paparazzi much better. In fact, I don't know it at all, because I just see these guys. I don't really know them.
Here you go, gentlemen. Regular Coke, and your double espresso and your regular coffee stronger on the way for you. Okay?
He gets the strong coffee.
Okay.
But I would, I mean, knowing the tough world that all journalism is. Okay. That just Steve Buscemi's as all good actors, he makes you feel what the guy's feeling inside. He makes you see who he really is.
Yes.
But the world of journalism, as I understand it, journalism now, not paparazzi, is that you have to put on a face.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be Henry Kissinger. And therefore, you're not going to make the faux pas that he makes. You're not going to call the doorman an asshole, because the next time you're going to have that much more difficulty.
Right.
You know, so you feel badly about the guy from the get-go, because he doesn't
What's
seem
that?
To have.
Ingrid Breakfast Tea?
No.
You
ever
heard of Ingrid Breakfast Tea?
No, I had a double espresso.
Oh.
That's okay.
Okay.
No problem.
Coming. So I was just thinking the poor guy is not social skills wise.
Right.
How many, I guess, so my question is...
I like your observations, man. That's very, very good.
But you know the world, because obviously you researched it, you know it, backwards and forward. I don't know it, so...
Right.
I presume you're going to tell me that most guys are like that, yes. Don't have the social skills.
It depends. You see, I didn't know that much about paparazzi. All I knew about them was, on one level... what the world knew, and particularly in terms of the case of Diana, mm-hmm. You know, how horrific that was, and in my own experience, throwing most of them off the sets of my films right when I'm trying to do a shot. Mm. One guy, I was in the middle of shooting.
You mean your outdoor stuff?
Yeah.
Because you like to shoot, obviously.
Yeah.
Au naturel.
I was doing a scene on Park Avenue. And the light was going, and I just needed a shot of Daryl Hannah walking across the street for The Real Blonde. Mm-hmm. And just as we were about to get it, you know, this guy jumps right in the frame and takes his picture. I was so furious. I jumped out. I said, I was outraged because of the disrespect. Mm-hmm. That's all. If he wants his picture, fine. But ruining my shot to get it?
Mm-hmm.
I said, God damn it. You know, have some respect for what we're doing here. You know, and he goes, go ahead, man, hit me, I'll sue you. Well, it actually fascinated me. And a month or two later, I ran into this guy at a party.
Uh-oh.
Oh.
Sorry.
You have a coffee and a double espresso.
Coffee for him, double espresso for me.
Okay.
Turning this off. I'm trying to turn it off. Sorry. Anyway, that was the...
And so I went up to him and I said, listen, I have this idea. I was thinking about making a movie about a paparazzi, you know. And his first reaction was to kind of flinch, like he thought I was going to hit him.
Mm.
But I ended up spending 2 months with him. And
this particular guy?
Yes. He took me out on jobs. He showed me all the different ins and outs of the thing. You know?
Who was it? Can you tell me?
Steve Sands.
S-A-N-D-S?
Yes. Right?
What agency did he make
I'm not sure, but we gave him technical advisor. Can you help me out for a second? Okay. He's a little crazy, mm-hmm. So I don't want him thinking the movie's about him. Okay?
Okay, sure.
All right? I gave him credit as technical advisor,
okay.
But I spoke to a lot of paparazzi. I don't want him thinking that, oh, yeah.
We're making a big thing about how he's trying to say that's really me and all that
Would
stuff.
You mind? Okay, that would be helpful. But anyway, here's what I saw. That on the one hand, I would ask him, don't you feel bad? Do you ever feel bad about some of this stuff that you
mm-hmm.
do? Never. Never. These people are stars. No one asked them to be famous. Fuck them. This comes with the territory. Besides, they're no different than me and you. They're nobody. A second later, I said, did you ever, how about De Niro? Oh, De Niro. Oh, my God. I shook his hand once. I felt this current go right through my body. And I said, what a schizophrenia. It's like, on the one hand, they do feel like they're the scum of the earth. On the other hand, they feel like they're right up there with the gods. You know? And I said, what a perfect analogy for this character, this guy, Pop, you know, Steve Buscemi. That's how he created that character. And I'm interested in that, because without too much of a stretch, and please, you know, forgive me for making this leap, but that kind of schizophrenia, I think, exists on some level in our society
mm-hmm.
today. This isn't just a movie about a paparazzi.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay for like this?
You know, I always try to just set it right there.
Thank you very much. So kind.
I always try to give things, you know, some sort of resonance that goes beyond the literal in the film.
Mm-hmm.
That this idea that, you know, he struggles every day to find something of value in himself.
Right.
He's been treated like shit. His sense of value is so crippled. And his struggle becomes trying to get through every day. In some ways, that does represent to me what I feel the world is going through. Why we have this fixation with celebrity right now. It's like an escape from some responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I'm saying? If you understand what I'm saying, then I won't elaborate. Okay, great. No, I could. I just want to, because I like this idea that, you know, in a world that gives enormous importance to things that have no value, how do you find real value?
There's a piece that Manola Dorcas wrote about Comic-Con, and it came out last Friday.
Uh-huh.
She had it at the end of the piece. She mentioned how all of us wake up and we kind of live in realms, in particular realms of our own devising.
Right.
You know, but exactly what you're saying. This right. guy's living in a realm, and this is his way of keeping out all the energy that he feels. It's just not doing anything for him, or right. maybe taking him down, whatever.
Right. Yeah. But he's had a few tough blows. I mean, the film is also about family in a way. You know, his family has done a heavy number on him. Toby's character, Michael Pitt, you know, his family has literally thrown him out of the house.
Yeah.
Karma's parents are suing her. I'm interested in the tangles that happen with familial stuff, you know, and how you free yourself from that. Sometimes you don't survive.
Have you ever, I mean, I don't mean to lay on the literalist thing, but do you, in the world that I know, if you were struck up a relationship with a hot actress, and it happens, right. you know, you don't have to be a prince from England to meet, you know, it can happen, I understand that. But if you were to burn her by bringing Steve Buscemi to your party, you'd be over, that would be it. You would definitely not get back.
Right, yes.
I mean, that's the rule.
That's the rule.
You know.
So. I love that scene. I mean, there's so much I could talk to you about. How much time do we have, by the way?
Only about 15 minutes.
That scene is a critical scene in the movie because yeah. Buscemi is rendered speechless in the presence of the stars that he has been proclaiming all this time that they're equal to. It shows in a flash what he really feels about himself. He can't talk. And the first thing he does is wash his hands. You know, that's what his mother has, you know, instilled in him. And so then he resorts to the only thing he knows, which is taking the pictures. You know, which ruins the relationship between Toby and Karma. You know? Buscemi is just so amazing in the film. I love the way he commits. He brings an emotional richness to this part that I don't think he has put or allowed himself to put in many roles. Do you agree? Do you agree?
My favorite Buscemi performance of the last, say, 2-3 years is still the Sopranos thing. But this is right after that.
Good. Good.
He's very, you know, the hostility is pretty insistent with him. But the art of the guy, the art of his technique, is that it's not all hostility. And you can feel the undercurrent of loneliness.
How about the scene where he comes back from his parents and his father has just taken this photograph?
And he takes it on Michael Pitt.
Yeah, but he cries. He sits there and he cries. And, you know, that's a very intense moment for Steve. I've never seen him do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole scene at the end of the film where he has to say goodbye to the kid, it reveals a depth of I mean, nothing is said in that sequence. I think people sometimes overlook what he does because he's so brilliant at it.
Oh, everybody loves him. He was fantastic the thing with
yes, he
that
is.
Too.
He Gold is
really superb.
I know, but sometimes people say, "Oh, yeah, Buscemi's just doing what he normally does." I don't.
Oh, he does always play a guy with anger and an edge.
Would you like water? Would you like to wait a little bit?
Oh, we're cool. Did you want anything to eat?
All right, not a problem. Would you like water?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know what you mean, though. They say he's doing the same riff on the same idea.
He's never cried in a movie. To me, if I'm a Buscemi, you know, aficionado, and I look at that, I go, oh, that's new. What's new?
You've been your ascendancy began with the Brad Pitt film,
Johnny's Way,
in 1990, sorry, and 90, and then Living in Oblivion was 94,
right.
And that was has been come to regard as kind of the golden beginning, the flowering of the independent age, the early 90s. Did you consider that when it was happening, that we were sort of in the middle of a great flowering of independent cinema and things that had taught?
I did. Not so much in terms of making that movie, but just how it felt being in New York at that time. It was really exciting to think that you could make a movie for no money. And that somehow someone would buy it and it would end up on a screen and people would go see it. I think it really affected the kinds of movies I remember just many, many different films that I were just thrilled to be able to see that were possibilities as alternatives to Hollywood cinema. I have nothing against Hollywood cinema. The only thing I ask for is a little equal time.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. You know? I mean, Oblivion actually came as a result of my intense frustration out of not being able to make what I thought was going to be my second film, which was Box of Moonlight. And so, you know, I just grabbed some people, mm-hmm. wrote a script, put all of my frustration into the comedy of it, and made Living in Oblivion for nothing. So
the gestation, the development of that script was not that long, you're saying?
Well, if you consider that, it actually went through the whole period of making Johnny Suede, which was a grueling experience, then 4 years of trying to make Box of Moonlight, right? Take all that, condense it into one instant of an idea. Mm. I said, let me make a movie about, you know, just trying to do one shot on a low-budget movie.
Mm.
It came out pretty easily, because I guess the gestation period was about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it wrote itself in about a week.
Really?
I'm serious. I'm not kidding you.
I love hearing that. When things happen that quickly.
Well, it's kind of like a volcano.
Yeah. Building. That's cool. What do you feel, you have obviously the hindsight, it's been 17 years since the Brad Pitt film. How are things significantly different in your view, in terms of financing, in terms of the receptivity to, what's it like now, in your opinion?
I think we're in a very tricky spot. There is no question in my mind. And this is not sour grapes. It's very difficult for a director, an independent director, to speak about things that they feel require some looking at. So let's just put it that way, without sounding like I'm complaining. I'm not complaining. These are the facts. An independent film today is governed by and dictated by the exact same requirements that a Hollywood film is.
Mm-hmm.
Box office, star power. How's it going to do? You know,
mm-hmm.
It comes out on an opening weekend. Opening weekend for a film that has an advertising budget of $300,000.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas The Bourne Identity, I'm sure they probably spent $10 million. How are you going to compete with that? But they're asking you to, and the expectations are exactly the same. If you don't perform opening weekend, you are dead. I think it's affecting the kinds of independent films that are being financed now. Do you see what I'm saying? Because then they're going to go, oh, okay, if we need to compete on opening weekend, then we need a film that's going to somehow stylistically and dramatically compete with The Bourne Identity or Shrek or Spider-Man.
Mm.
It's having an effect. It's having an effect. Do you agree? Do you agree?
Well,
I
try and, you know, write about films that have performed this way and that way, and I try and put it in perspective. It's a smaller film without the big, obvious popcorn elements that have, it's a little more of a smallish film that's character-driven. Maybe the names aren't as big as Matt Damon. You try and put it in perspective.
Right.
So you're saying that the money people, the studio people, think this way, right?
Theater owners.
Okay, theater owners. Okay.
Distributors, the people that finance the film. Because what happens is that they instantly perceive, okay, is that a sinkhole? Are we just throwing money away now?
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that we just pull the plug and cut our losses?
Mm-hmm.
Or do we increase the ad? Do we keep the ad going another week? I mean, it's really ruthless thinking.
How about the financing of independent films? I've been hearing for the last 2-3 years about the hedge fund multimillionaires, they're putting money in. Is
right.
that still happening right now?
Again, it all depends on the product or the project. I mean, I started out with Delirious by going through every single, you know, entrance on the very nice doorway of street of independent financiers.
Mm-hmm.
There's only about 10 of them, but it's where you start. I started every single one. Knock, knock, knock. Here's the script.
Mm-hmm.
They all passed.
So then becomes, where do you go next?
Mm-hmm.
Then, because then there's a list of sort of financiers that didn't, you know, knocked on all those doors. They all passed. Where do you go next? I went to Europe. I got a nibble. That enabled me to get another nibble. It all depends on the product. If someone sees this as wow, I'm going to be able to make a lot of money off of this, then yeah, hedge fund people will come in immediately. But it just all depends on what they see as the financial return.
When you see when you talk about financiers on this part of this side of the pond in America, do you mean people who are brokers or representatives of various hedge fund multimillionaires?
Yes, or have access to money and like right. You know, large amounts of money that they don't know what to do with,
mm-hmm.
and they think that getting involved in film is exciting,
mm-hmm.
and they do. In this case, I lucked out by cutting the budget.
Mm-hmm.
I cut the budget, made it, enticing to one company, this company, Peace Arch Entertainment.
How do you spell that?
Peace Arch, P-E-A-C-E, Peace Arch, A-R-C-H. And they financed the whole film. So, you know, after 6 years. You know. But you should check out the website, delirious.com. Have you been there?
No.
Delirious?
Well, no, I can't remember if I have.
Maybe go to deliriousthemovie.com.
Mm-hmm.
What you'll see there are some things you might find interesting. First of all, those two clips, right? You're going to see the one with Gina and the one with Steve.
Mm-hmm.
But also I wrote a blog that's you might find interesting. It's a developing blog.
What's the thing in the press kit about you slugging a guy who was writing the press kit or something?
What that is an example of me having to do almost every single thing that needed to be done on this movie, which was right before we started coming here, we realized no one had written production notes,
uh-huh.
so I wrote them.
Uh-huh.
I wrote them, and so that's why I just said, what the hell? I'll try to throw some humor into it.
Uh-huh.
I hope it doesn't come off as aggressive, does it?
Well, you are describing yourself having slugged the author of the notes. So I didn't.
Oh.
You wrote them.
That's good. That's good. Okay. Yeah. That's good. No, I said, what the hell? I was kind of pissed off that I ended up having to write my own production notes.
Okay.
You know. Yeah.
Well,
I selected the still that's used for the poster.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It just never ends. Hey there. Very well.
Had to move?
Yeah, they're ready for you.
Okay.
To be with Julie.
Okay.
And then we'll be ready for you in a few minutes, but you can either stay down here and get something to eat or...
Okay. I'm good. What time is it?
You want to come back
up? Wow, it's 1 o'clock.
Chaos?
What's the chaos?
Just two junkies, people running around all over the place.
No, I will pass on that. I may run up to my room and make a phone call.
This is really nice light. You mind if I take a shot of you here?
Go ahead. Don't forget your recorder.
I won't. I just like that it's kind of amber, yellowish. I just thought it might come out nicely.